Welcome back, everybody. So my guest today is someone I've wanted to speak to for several years now. He's one of the most recognisable voices and voiceover artists in the country. He's the author of one of the best Australian biographies that I've ever listened to, his book Lofty. And he's also one of the most talked about on-air talents from the halcyon days of the radio industry in our country in the 80s and 90s, Ian Lofty Fulton.
Joshua C. Liston, thank you so very much for inviting me.
The full name, I like that. It's you and my grandmother that call me Joshua now, so.
I only ever get Ian when I'm in trouble, and generally it is all three names, first, middle, and last. Yeah, so that way you really know you're in.
Well, it'll be Lofty for the rest of this conversation if you're okay with that.
Great. Excellent. It'll stop making me nervous, then. That's great.
So I was hoping we could start talking about Wagga. I'm a massive fan of your book and specifically your audio book, and I didn't even know, because it predates my time in the region, that you spent some time in Wagga. That's only about 75 minutes up the road from where I live.
Yep.
So I know you did speak in the book a little bit about Wagga, but now that you're 20 plus 30 years removed from Wagga, what do you still remember about that little country town? City, sorry. Wagga people will be upset I called it a town, city.
Oh, gosh, here, you can't call a city a town. We enjoyed our tour. Wagga was great for families. I was married at the time, and I had three young stepchildren, and so it was a great community town and very supportive of families and sport and activity. Like the boys, Jason and Ben, my two stepsons, got into Minky when they were in Wagga, which is, for those who don't know Minky, it's basically mini hockey, and hence the name Minky. They had embraced BMX riding, keeping in mind that this was, God, nearly 40 years ago now. When was I in Wagga? 1985, 86, I was in Wagga. And yeah, we actually bought a house there. So we looked at, you know, spending a considerable amount of time there because we liked it so much. And then things went a little bit south at work and it was time to move on. I mean, as you know, in the media industry, for those who aren't familiar, for want of a better term, it's like doing your apprenticeship. You start in a very small market. For instance, for me, I started in Burnie on the northwest coast of Tassie, and then I was offered a job in Shepparton in Victoria. That was a nighttime job. And when I was in Shepparton, I was then offered the job in Wagga, which was a daytime job doing, at the time, I think it was noon till three I was doing. And, I have some fond memories of Wagga.
Yeah, so Wagga, it's funny. I already felt a connection to your story and also just your voice. It's so rich, particularly on that recording. It's just incredible. But as soon as you started talking about Wagga, it felt like more of a personal connection for two reasons. One, it's become the most important city for me in terms of my stand-up comedy development. It's where I've had it's where I've had the most opportunities, and the people that have supported me probably the most thus far are actually based there. And secondly, I played so many gigs there back when I was in a band. It was a real music-heavy place, Wagga. And there was a lot of opportunities. They were choosing bands over DJs still in the early 2000s, which I found even different to Albury Wodonga, only an hour and a half away. It was more a DJ-heavy place. But it was the first time, and I know you've experienced this, and I don't want to take us on a dark turn here, Lofty, but it was the first time loading something into the back of a car where I hurt my lower back, which has pained me on and off. And been living in the back of my mind as a limiting thing sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Ever since that day in my early 20s, and it was just a clumsy, I lifted a base cab up, I hurt myself. And so I've got some of the best memories and that one really annoying incident all burned into my mind, all about Wagga.
Well, yep, I totally get where you're coming from with that. And having, as you know, without offering too many spoilers on the book, as you know, I've had issues with my back from what you would have read. Yeah. And funnily enough, a lot of people say, how did you hurt your back? Yours obviously was lifting something awkwardly or was a little too heavy at the time. But a lot of people, when you talk to them, they'll say, oh, well, I bent down to tie up my shoelace. It's something innocuous that they do, and it triggers that memory of what they did to their back, because anyone who's ever hurt their back remembers exactly how, where, and when they did it, probably even down to the detail of what they were wearing at the time. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, mine was I'd probably had one too many Red Bulls and or beers to be lifting anything at 2 o'clock in the morning. So,
yeah, that would do it. Yeah. That would do it, yeah. A bit of false bravado always goes a long way towards hurting your back, yeah.
It definitely does. So where I kind of was going with that was, it's one of those little things that when I really think about, just say I'm thinking about traveling somewhere, mm-hmm. and one example is I was thinking about one day going to New Zealand and doing some of the adventure tourism stuff. Yep. And my first thought was, because that's always living there in the back of my mind, is, oh, what if I hurt my back and then I have a miserable trip, or I can't get to a chiropractor, or I don't have my guy over there that can give me the correction. It's just living there in the back of my mind. And that is kind of, I felt like a through line in the book, that you're such an incredible talent and you've worked so hard, and we'll get into parts of your career, but that there has been little things that have just been niggling in the background for you. And
oh, for sure.
I was just hoping maybe we could talk about a few of those and then move into your broader career. So
yeah, sure. With my back, inherently, it's part and parcel. And for those listening who obviously don't have the benefit of having vision accompanying this podcast, I have dwarfism, and there are different kinds of dwarfism, but the one that a lot of people would be familiar with if they've seen Game of Thrones is Peter Dinklage, who was in that series and brilliant actor, and I applaud what he has done with his career, because he certainly has more courage to get in front of the camera than I do. But Peter Dinklage has what is known as achondroplasia, and how that is denoted is short long bones being your arms and legs. So we have short legs, normal length torso, which can then give that odd appearance of being out of proportion, and also an enlarged skull. So putting it all together, it can lead to a, let's call a spade, an odd appearance to many, to the average person. And I say average in air quotes. But one of the inherent issues with dwarfism is spinal issues. Some people go through their entire life, thankfully, not encountering too many issues with their spine, but I got the short straw on that occasion to date. My first spinal operation was in 2001, and since I had two in that year, and then since 2014, I've had six more. So I've had a total of eight spinal ops since 2001. So basically, and there's really not a lot more that they can do. But what it comes down to is the spinal canal, which accommodates your spinal cord. Say, for instance, with you, Josh, let's just use an example that people would be familiar with, and I'm using the Australian currency, sorry, for those who may be listening to this overseas. But think of your spinal cord being, say, the diameter of a 5-cent piece, and it sits inside your spinal canal, which is, say, the diameter of a 20-cent piece. For Americans who may be listening, sort of the difference between a quarter and a penny sort of thing. And for myself, it's more like a 5-cent piece to a 10-cent piece. And to the Americans who might be listening, a nickel to a dime, that kind of ratio. So there's a lot less room around the outside of the spinal cord, which has that fluid to buffer it and protect it. So it's easy for the, you know, that's the easiest way I can explain it, but it's quite easy for the nerves to become aggravated with so little room to move. And unfortunately, it got that way on eight occasions where it required surgery to correct it. Otherwise, you know, I was going to be living with reasonably severe pain.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. And that gives some context onto parts of the book where the back issues, and I don't want to dwell on that too much today, Lofty, but they were kind of like this little monster that would rear its head sometimes at the absolute worst possible time, particularly if you felt like things were starting to really trend up for you personally. Absolutely. Or in your career. But I've read the book now through three times, or listened to it.
Oh my God.
And
thank you.
Minimum two for a book I love, but if it's more than that, I'll try to do three or more. And I hear different things every time. And
so you've listened to the audio book, but you've got a physical copy of the book as well, though.
Just the audio. Yeah. So just the audio book at the moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I didn't realize it was that many actual operations that you were going through, or that many acute circumstances with the back.
Well, at the time of release of the book, which was just before COVID, so 2019, the sum total of operations at that point in time was six. So there had been two more since the book came out.
Wow. Now that we've gone full depth into the back stuff, I'm going to move us away from that and maybe into something a little more positive. So you did mention your dwarfism in there. And there's this amazing part of the book where you're going to a voiceover conference, I think maybe for the first time in the US.
And
in the book, you use the phrase, and it happens quite often, you meet people and they're surprised by, quote, someone so short sounding so tall. And I had to stop and type that into my phone, because there was parts of the book leading up to that where that had seemed like something maybe you didn't have the language to explain. And then at that particular time, you kind of maybe found the language to explain how people were reacting. And the way you performed that part was, though, it was maybe becoming something you were seeing more as a positive.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't want to put words in your mouth by any means, Lofty. And this is just from, and to be honest, I might have overabsorbed the book. It might be one of those things.
You may well have done.
Yeah.
Having heard it now three times, you might have done.
Yeah. So I don't want to say that that's what you were thinking, but I just thought it was such a great turn of phrase. Someone so short sounding so tall. I want to talk about, when was the first moment that someone talked to you about your voice and made you feel like, oh, maybe I won't say gift, because that might be a little woo-woo for some people, but maybe I have some intrinsic talent here, and if I work on that, that can be a thing, being your voice. Who was the first person that mentioned it to you where you really thought, I've got something there?
Oh, gosh. To give credit where credit is due, it was my mother who, when my voice broke, suggested to me that I should consider a career in radio, and this was in the late 70s. And of course, at that time, I was an obnoxious teenager who, you know, whatever your parents said, you had the opposite opinion. Didn't matter. If they said black, you said white.
Yeah.
Anyone who's got teenagers knows exactly, or anyone who's got kids knows exactly what a defiant child is like. So to her credit, she was the one who guided me on the path of thinking about radio. I didn't know that voiceover at the time was a thing I could do. And even, I didn't even think radio. I am, at the time of us talking now, I'm 59 years old. So in the growing up in the 60s and 70s, radio was a big part of your life. Mm. You took it everywhere you went, basically. You had a radio in the car. You know, you might have had a transistor radio, as they used to be known. And this is before the days of iPods and Walkmans and things like that. And you thought of radio as only being done by special people. So when Mum suggested it, of course, I said, Mum, that's just for the stars, you know, forget it. And she then suggested it to my speech and drama teacher during my matriculation years, or HSC, as it's often known as. And when the speech and drama teacher said, you should think about radio, it was like, oh, that's a great idea, but the credit belongs to my mother. But did I know it would lead to what I'm doing now? No, didn't have a clue.
That's fascinating. And there's so many parts in the first 10 to 15 chapters of the book where your mum comes up as just someone that was just championing you along the way. So that's an incredible element of the book. So one thing I think is interesting is we hear the radio now, Lofty, and the big voiced, for the lack of a better term, the big voiced presenter that maybe has some preternatural gift for the big, deep presentation is maybe less common than it was then. So when you say special people, it's not just talented, funny, smart people, but at the time, I'm assuming it was also people that were blessed with a certain quality of voice as well.
With a decent set of pipes. I think certainly back then it was modeled on people with appealing voices, shall we say, because, and appealing doesn't necessarily mean a deep voice or anything like that, but a warmth to their voice that makes people feel reassured when listening to them, or people enjoy listening to that particular presenter for whatever reason that may be. So, but yeah, the bigger voice was certainly very prevalent during the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s.
Yep. So talking about appealing voices, last night I drove from Albury to Falls Creek up the mountain to host a trivia night. So I'm not sure if Lofty knows how far that is. It's about a 2-hour drive. It's a pretty hectic drive from Mount Beauty up to Falls Creek, which is through the Alpine.
Yep.
And you were that voice last night. And to be honest, there's some audiobooks that I could have been listening to where the person may have been gifted with that big presenter style audio narration voice, that it would have been dangerous for me to be listening to them driving because they would have put me to sleep.
You might have fallen asleep. Exactly. Not exactly what you want to be doing when you're behind the wheel of a
car. No, not at night coming down those windy, windy trails. They're basically just fancy goat tracks, some parts of that road.
Yep.
So you have a character in your voice, but it leads me to think, and I'm just going to keep coming back to the audiobook. I'm sorry the listeners, Lofty might not know this, but they know I'm absolutely fascinated with the way people transmit emotion through their voice. And it's really maybe my passion as much as what it is the audience's. How did you approach retelling those stories in the audio book, given you're the only person in the world that kind of already knows how they all end? Like, how did you put so much genuine emotion into all of those stories and keep them sounding like a lot of them sound like it was the first time you'd ever said them out loud? That's how real they felt.
Thank you for saying that. Fun fact, it's the first audio book I've ever done. It's the only one I've ever done, because audiobooks are a lot of hard work. This one was easier for me, obviously, because I knew the content and I'd written the content. And I had firstly had it put in the contract that I was the one to do the audiobook, because I couldn't imagine anyone else doing it. And it would have, not that they wouldn't do it properly, but because they didn't know the story as intimately as what, of course, I do, having written it, some of the nuance might have been lost, because the English language is one of those, it is probably one of the most difficult languages for anyone trying to learn it who's a foreign speaker, because nuance is everything. Inflection, cadence, the whole lot. And to give listeners an example of what I mean is, what's that on the road ahead? What's that on the road ahead? So same thing being said. Yeah, it's like, okay, do they mean ahead, or as in front of me, or is that someone's head on the road?
That's brilliant. So
there's that kind of nuance that can be lost if somebody's not as familiar with the story, of course, as what I am.
There's this brilliant line, and I don't want to give away too much about specifics from the book. I would encourage everyone to go and read the book and absolutely listen to it. If you've never signed up to Audible and you've got that free offer to get a free book, use that, pay for it, do whatever you need to. It's just such an incredible performance.
The book that we're actually talking about is Lofty, My Life in Short.
Yes, I'll attach some links to the book where people can find that in the show notes.
You can do that with all this newfangled back in my day, we used to use tape recorders.
Well, I'm actually when it comes to guitar and guitar gear, I'm a bit of an old school analog person. So in certain parts of my life, I'm stuck in the 80s and 90s. So there's this line where you're talking about returning to Tasmania and you go to see your dad. And he's managing a store, and he asks you at the time, I'm not sure how long it had been since you'd been in the same physical space as him, but he asked you to mind the store, and he went and did whatever else he was doing. And I mean, I've listened, I think, probably to around 1,000 audiobooks in the last 10 or 12 years. And that would be, I reckon, and this is no hyperbole, I'm not a hyperbolic person. Anyone who knows me would say I'm almost the opposite a lot of the time. It would be in the top 50 lines I've ever heard in terms of transmission of what felt like real emotion. one of the questions I had was, there's so many massive moments and the way you present them is just so great throughout, particularly the audio, which is what I've experienced. What is it that people tell you about from the book? Because you have your own impressions of the stories, but what do people come back to you and tell you about?
People will often share with me that they too have had a battle with mental health, which has also been a big part of my life. I've received several emails from people that both I do and don't know who have taken the time to read or listen to the book and then felt compelled to sit down and write me a note what they felt about the book, both good and bad, obviously. To give you an example, we, as you know, Josh, in the book we also talk about bullying, which is, I endured quite a bit of that in my school days and also at times in the workplace. And there was, in particular, a Japanese lady who wrote to me. She's now living here in Australia. She married an Australian. So she has moved from a very distinct type of culture into our culture, which is almost totally the opposite of what she's used to. And she particularly wrote in this email what she felt in particular was when she was experiencing some bullying at work. And she said this in the email, I said to myself, what would Lofty do? And to know that you've had that effect on somebody and they have taken the time to share that with you is just, it's a feeling I can't quite describe. I can't quite articulate it, but it's very heartwarming.
I have the pleasure, and I think I consider it an honour to have been volunteering for a mental health podcast that I produce here in the studio where I'm sitting. And some of the feedback that show gets behind the scenes when the guys do share that with me, hey, we heard from a person and they said this. And it can be all different kinds of people from myriad backgrounds and places in life and different age groups. And a lot of the time it feels to me that it's the first time that person's ever been truly seen was listening to that particular show. And one moment for me was last night, particularly because my dad is over 80 years old now and he's always been quite stoic and not 100%, I guess, involved in the day-to-day of my life. He's always been there for me 100%. But it made me think, I've got a bit of a gratitude problem because I don't think that I've really realized just how great it is to have a version of a really positive relationship with my dad. Like it might not be like some of my friends, like my best friend, he's Uruguayan and his parents are loving and hugging. Like they basically are puking love all over each other for the lack of a better term. Yeah. My dad's much more reserved. But that was one thing about the book that I've taken away even just within the last 24 hours. And I guess that's me now sharing that with you as my thing. I felt seen, but in a different way that I actually needed to look back at myself because of your book.
Wow. Thank you. That's really quite profound. And I appreciate you sharing that.
And that's why I encourage people to read, but also reread things because that wasn't evident to me, Lofty, the first and second time.
Wow. It's funny you should say that because, I'll often listen to something that I thought I was familiar with and I'm listening to it again and it's like, wow, that's the first time I actually noticed that. So you're quite right. It can take two or three times for you to fully absorb the content or the nuances of the content.
Yep. So there's probably a lot of people out there that are listening to this, and I know some of them are definitely listening, that are people that are in the audio space because I'm pretty heavily involved in the podcast production and hosting shows. And what's the crossover point between, say, your radio career and voiceover? And what are the differences between those two types of things? And I know at one point you were on the launch of CFM. Is that correct? That'd be held up on the top five biggest and best radio launches in Australia. It's still talked about throughout. Everyone I know in radio talks about that.
Wow. And here we are some 30 plus years down the track. Yeah. At the time it was March 1989. And just to backtrack on how I arrived at that particular point, it was no more than 3 months prior to the launch of that radio station that I was at another radio station where I was being bullied. And it was I was being bullied by management, basically. And it was a horrible, horrible time in my career, and to the point where I actually considered leaving radio altogether, as in I felt that broken and had been made to think that I was that worthless of a contribution to the industry. I remember during this particular tirade from the manager who, along with the program director at the time, decided that it would be a great idea to give me a pep talk, as they saw it, from a demo that I had to record for a sister station, as to if they got this dreadful change of format that we had endured, this is what it was going to sound like. And for those in the audio space, they'll understand this, but for those who are not involved in the audio space, I did it in what was then called the off-air studio, or the spare studio, studio number two. It was a studio you went to if you had to, if something went wrong with the on-air studio itself. And this studio had not seen the touch of a technician for goodness knows how long. And so it wasn't calibrated in any way. And CDs were just starting to be used in the radio space. So this is mid to late 1980s. And commercial CD machines weren't available then. So they were using domestic machines, which is, you know, use anything domestically in a commercial space, it's not going to last. So the only thing I could actually set my level on was, and consistently, was my mic level. And one of the songs I had to play on this demo for the sister station was Tracy Chapman's Fast Car. And for anyone who's familiar with the song, it's a really, really quiet song when it starts. It's just this instrumental acoustic guitar. Josh, you could speak to that more than I can. I can't play an instrument, but...
And the masters of music then weren't getting crushed, so they're all hitting negative 0.5 dB back in the day either.
Yeah, exactly. So the meter was barely moving with this recording. So I got dragged into the manager's office and basically told... Sorry, did you say you won't swear?
I don't really mind. I don't swear that much on mic, but you can say whatever you like, mate, if you feel it's appropriate.
Well, to put it in context, this is the pep talk that I had from the manager. Whilst into his office, the program director sat in the chair next to me, and which was basically between the door and the office, so there was no escape route, so to speak. It was like being taken into the headmaster's office as a child in school. And so they sat me down and they said, okay, the manager went, we've learnt one thing from your demo tape. You'll never get a job at an FM station. Your fucking panelling is atrocious.
Oh, God.
And you sit on air playing with your voice. Who do you think you are, Jim Pilgrim? And it's like, you don't relate to women. We're fucking targeting a 28 to 35-year-old woman here. And I was married to one at the time, and she hated the station because it was just a dreadful format. And your production's fucked. Who do you think you are, Jim Pilgrim? For people listening who are not involved in this industry, Jim Pilgrim, the late Jim Pilgrim in Brisbane, was a well-renowned voiceover talent. And so he was also on air at this particular radio station. And I thought, here's me already anxious and apologising for my existence, thinking, no, of course I don't think I'm fucking Jim Pilgrim, blah, 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 you know, like all of this. Yeah. And I was just like, the latest in a long line of succession of abuse that I had had from these guys. And I said, well, you know, am I doing anything right? And he said, you keep turning up for work each day, keep doing that. Mm. And that was it. You know, like the diatribe was over, I was dismissed. So I went into the on-air studio to use the phone, rang my wife at the time and said, look, this is the latest of what's been going on. And she said, that's it. I don't care what you do now. Be a brickies labourer, whatever, but you're not staying there putting up with that abuse. So I then, and there is a point to this story that I'll tell you about, I then rang Jim Johnston, who was at 4BH at the time, and I'd worked with him at this station before it had changed format. And I just said, Jim, this is what's going on. And he said, look, sit tight, we'll have you out of there in 24 hours. And he rang me back and he said, okay, this is the name of the station manager. He's expecting a call. I've told him what's going on. We've got mid-dawns up for grabs here and, you know, a couple of other things. So let's give him a call. He's waiting to hear from you. And, of course, you've got to be careful as to what you say to a prospective employer. You can't go bagging too much the place that you're at. But he asked me the question. He said, so what do you think the issue is? I said, I really don't know. I said, I just can't do anything right, whether it's a clash of personalities or whatever. So I said, oh, well, look, come on over to us. So I was there, and it was when I was there, I'd only been there a couple of weeks, I was offered the job at CFM. And the irony of what I was told, the key points of this dressing down that I got from managers were, you'll never get a job at an FM station, your paneling is fucked. You sit on air playing with your voice not relating to women. Who do you think you are, Jim Pilgrim? And there was something else in there. And these were the words, and sort of these were the words that were used. So, like in this day and age, you would well and truly sue an employer if they treated you that way. The irony of it was I was then offered the morning shift, also known for those not involved in our industry. Back when Noah was a boy and radio was in its infancy, you could only listen to radio at home. You didn't go to work and listen to the radio. You know, the father had a job to do. So the father left for the day for work and the dutiful housewife stayed at home taking care of domestic duties whilst listening to the radio. So the only listeners at that time of day generally were women. So hence the shift became known as women's. And so I got a phone call saying, starting a brand new FM station on the Gold Coast, heard some of your production, would like to work with you on that, and also would like to offer you the women's shift. All the things I'm no good at, you're offering me a job for. And the beauty, Josh, of this was that at the time when CFM started, yeah, and there was so much buzz around it, like it launched with a concert, an in-studio concert with Jimmy Barnes, Johnny Diesel, luminaries of the rock and roll, the Australian rock and roll industry, and being broadcast around. That was how the radio station launched, with a concert from these guys. And it was so to be standing in the other studio, and as you know, studios are often connected by rather large windows, just to be standing there watching Jimmy Barnes and Johnny Diesel and John Stevens from Noiseworks perform. And it was just mind-blowing, and the buzz around the station was phenomenal. It was a huge part of the community down there. And like you say, the launch is still talked about to this day. And the beauty of it was I knew that at the studios in Auchenflower in Brisbane, they could hear CFM booming in. They had sort of like they tune into it. It's like, yeah, so I'll never get a job at an FM station, huh? sit on air playing with my voice. Who do I think I am? Jim Pilgrim? Here I am doing women's. And guess what? I got hired because of my production. So I suppose also the moral of that story is just keep in mind that people's opinions are like anuses. Everybody's got one, but you won't necessarily want to hear from them.
Today I was hoping maybe we could dive into something that you've had, a challenge that you've had to overcome mostly in your voiceover career or whatever creative endeavors you have going at the moment since the book's come out. So post-book, what are some challenges or a specific challenge you've had to overcome in your creative life?
Well, it's still a challenge for me, and I would say I haven't overcome it, but it is a dream of mine to do movie trailers in the US market. I've always loved movie trailers growing up, back in the days when the TV was a beautiful piece of furniture that sat in the corner of the lounge room, not something you could take portably with you on any screen that you have at your disposal. So during the ad breaks was the time that you might go out to the kitchen, get a drink, or go to the bathroom or whatever. But when you were out of the room, if you heard that big American voice of Don LaFontaine and his compatriots going, in a world, you knew that it was about a movie. So I'd, of course, come running in to see what it was all about. But they have always held a fascination for me. But as I sit here at the moment, I self-sabotage myself a lot on the American accent.
So two things. One, I want to know, what do you mean by self-sabotage yourself on the accent?
In the sense of I haven't mastered the accent. There's a block there for me that I'm not sure how to get around confidence-wise to maintain it.
Okay.
To maintain the confidence and put into practice what I know. So the self-sabotaging is that voice inside your head that might be going, what do you think you're doing? You're not good at this, blah, 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 blah. You know, the inner critic that many of us are familiar with. So once I have, that's a challenge I'm still yet to fully overcome because I would love to work on a regular basis in the American market.
And just before my second part of the question that comes up, is that critic busy both before you even start recording with the American accent and or if you're doing it well, is it still there telling you that, oh, this is going great, this is going to come to an abrupt end here, you can't keep smashing it like this.
Yeah, you can't keep smashing it like this. It's, you know, who do you think you're fooling sort of thing. And Josh, you know, as a performer, both, well, in all the ilks of performance that you do, whether it be music, comedy, whatever the case may be, there are nights when you're on it, like you're nights, days, whichever the case may be, that the performance is, say, faultless and easy. And there are days when it's a real grind. You're just not feeling it. If I start out with that lack of confidence, it becomes a grind.
Okay.
It's just a lack of confidence in my own ability, basically.
Like, it can happen any time, even when you think you're going well.
Yeah, this is going well. And then the other voice on the other shoulder goes, is it? Is it really going that well? Are you sure? And then the self-doubt creeps in. And it can be crippling. The anxiety can be crippling.
From what I can gather in the book, you're much better at surrounding yourself with people in your world that are mostly positive. But do you ever get the feedback when you talk about that of – you're the voice of MasterChef or have been previously, Toyota in Australia, McDonald's, you were a radio host on that was well regarded for your on-air and off-air work. You're one of the more recognisable voices in our country. Why isn't that enough, Lofty? Do you ever get that? Like, why is America on this pedestal for you? Why is that the thing when you've already done so much? Or do you actively filter out people like that that may have that kind of attitude?
No, I don't. And I thank you for acknowledging what I've done up until this point. I really do appreciate it and you put it into a great perspective. It's just to clarify, it's not that it's not enough as in I am not satisfied, I want more in the sense of a greed thing.
Yeah.
That's not what it's about. It's more an itch I can't scratch. If that kind of makes sense. It's something I've always wanted to achieve, and not having achieved it is an itch I haven't scratched, if that kind of makes sense.
That can, in the right frame of mind, be a positive driver too for action, I think.
Yeah, can be a motivator, but can also be a limiter, so to speak.
Correct, and that can change day to day. I think we've discovered that today through our conversation.
Yes,
so
sure.
I just wanted to finish up with a new segment. And this is for the real audio nerds out there. So this is going to be just a quick fire. I'm going to call this the audio nerd corner. And I'm just want to 30 seconds on some of the gear that you use. Because believe it or not, when I talk to people in the audio world, even though this show's about so much more, they're the questions I get from people. Oh, what mic was he using? Or what was this? Or what was that? And you didn't ask him about this thing. Mm. So can I just throw like five things at you super quick, Lofty?
You certainly can. Go right ahead.
Where are you recording? Home, studio, and do you have a booth?
I have a booth. It's actually a homemade booth. What it is four internal doors, hollow core doors lined with audio foam, put together in a square configuration with a roof on it as well. So it's sound protected as opposed to soundproof. We're in a rental property, so we can't make any structural changes. And we're in a fairly quiet environment. It's not a booth that would suit living right next door to a major six-lane highway with trucks traversing up and down all day. So that's what I use, and it works really well. I've used that for about 17 years now.
And what's your current microphone, or do you have a dream mic it's not that?
There's two microphones in the booth. One is the Sennheiser MKH-416. which is the industry standard around a lot of studios, both commercial studios and also
big muscular kind of sound.
Yeah, the Sennheiser is a really great microphone if you are in a slightly noisier environment, because they, and Josh, you're an audio nerd, I am not.
They're hypercardioid from memory. Yeah, what, Josh, or supercardioid.
If you think of it like a torchlight, when it goes out, it has a beam. Their beam is confined to not sucking in everything else around it. And also in the booth is a Neumann U87. Now, they are probably the dream mic. Yeah, it's
well, there's not just voice people out there hearing that. There'll be musicians and vocalists and other artists that are hearing that going, yeah, that is the dream. So the last thing is, and this is more potentially controversial question, are you a Mac guy in your audio work, or are you a Windows person?
There is no controversy whatsoever. Hands down, Mac.
I'm happy you said that, because I also feel that way.
Yeah, hands
down, Mac. Whenever the argument comes up, I'm like, wasn't that sorted 10 years ago?
I ventured, and not just from the audio side of it, it even predated doing studio stuff. I am, you know, being the old fart that I am not necessarily technologically gifted, either with IT skills or technical skills really at all. I leave that up to people who know. The beauty of Mac, and I was in the Windows world there for a while, primarily because it was a cheaper entry level, but just so many issues. I kind of think of it like this. In Windows, you can erase your entire hard drive, and it tells you after the fact that you've just erased your entire hard drive. Whereas, thankfully, in the Mac world, it says you are about to erase your entire hard drive, losing absolutely everything. Are you sure you want to do that? Yes. Are you doubly sure you want? Just to be certain, before we go ahead and do this, I'm going to ask you one more time. No. How did I even get to this point? Whereas a Windows computer will tell you after you've done it.
Yeah. I always say to my PC friends that are always on me about how powerful a PC is for so much less money, and I always say to them, if you can make that as reliable as what I'm using and I can pay half as much, I'd be doing that in 2 seconds.
Oh, God, yeah.
Like, I don't want to spend thousands. I'd rather spend hundreds. And but it's just not there yet.
And if you can make it as stable a platform and virus-free and all of that, go right ahead.
So the book, Lofty, My Life in Short, is available all the places you can get books. Go out there, tweet about it, or X about it, whatever you call that now. If you see this on Instagram, obviously if you listen to the whole podcast, let us know. Either let Lofty know, or myself, or both of us, what you felt about today. That would be amazing. And your website, loftyfulton.com.
And you can also look up about the book at loftymylifeinshort.com.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate it. I'm sure that everyone who's listening does as well. Thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate it, Josh. Again, thank you for asking me to be on here today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Cheers.